When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 143. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am heading over the Atlantic to Louisville in Kentucky to talk to university professor and filmmaker Peter Bick. Peter, how are you?
I'm doing well, Will. Thank you. I wish I was there in person, but this is the next best thing.
So, ever since I watched Carbon Cowboys, I've been really excited about talking to you. So, thanks so much for giving up your time to come on the show. It is a real pleasure to have you here.
Indeed. My pleasure.
You are in Louisville at the moment, but usually you live and work in Phoenix, Arizona.
Correct.
Describe it to us. Is it a nice place to live and work? Pretty good weather, I'd imagine, over there.
Phoenix right now and for the next 3 or 4 months is going to be about 105 to 110 degrees every day. with an urban heat island effect, it doesn't cool off at night like the sort of mythological desert cools off at night. So it's a tough summer there, which is why we're in Louisville.
Yeah.
We have a really good life. Our boys' school is like a mile from our house. My office is 3 miles away. I have an electric car and I just scoot down and park and go teach. And everything's close. So we live in central Phoenix. I'm allergic to traffic and commuting. I lived in Los Angeles for 26 years and that's just not a way to live, in my opinion.
Yeah. So where are you from originally?
I'm from Louisville.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I'm from Kentucky, so I did the migration west, go west, young man.
Yeah,
when I went out to college to learn filmmaking, so I went to LA.
Sure, my wife and I have just finished watching Justified, the box set, which is set in Kentucky. So
the accents. I haven't seen a Kentucky film with the accents very accurate. Mm. Those accents are all over the place. We're kind of picky about that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I want to ask you about accents when we get on to talking about Carbon Cowboys, because there's some brilliant accents in that. But now you have a very varied and impressive CV. Give us a bit of a summary of what you do.
Well, right now, I'm a professor of practice at Arizona State University. So that's since 2013. Prior to that, I was your average filmmaker living in LA, trying to make things work, editing stuff for people during the day and working on my own projects at night, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I made a movie called Garbage back in the 90s. And then I was at the world premiere of An Inconvenient Truth, and that really got to me. The issue of climate change really got to me in that movie. And so that's when we decided to make Carbon Nation. And so when we were making Carbon Nation, we moved from LA back to Kentucky to raise our kid and just get out of LA and have affordable housing and trees and family.
Yeah.
And then I got the job in Arizona in 2013. So we had about 4 years back here. Mm-hmm. So I'm a filmmaker and I teach students how to make documentaries about sustainable situations, sustainability, regeneration. I highly recommend they focus on solutions, but I don't mandate. Mm-hmm. But I've been teaching students. I teach students from the School of Sustainability and the School of Journalism at ASU. So it's a nice mix. So they get to teach each other their skill sets. The sustainability students learn filmmaking and the journalism students learn about sustainability. And I can tell you that journalists have a big need to keep learning about sustainability and regeneration. I can tell you that it's still a huge need to communicate that stuff.
Mm. Now you've done a lot of public speaking, including presenting at places such as Google, Facebook, McDonald's, Nike, Boeing, Microsoft, and conferences and events all around the world. Obviously being a guest on Rock and Roll Farming podcast puts those experiences in the shade, but
of course,
what kind of things are you talking about when you address these people?
Yeah. So a lot of those presentations were coming out of our film Carbon Nation, which mm-hmm. is a climate change solutions movie that doesn't even care if you believe in climate change. And our goal was to really talk about the solutions to climate change just make sense. Yeah. Like one of the characters in our films, like, even if you're a greedy bastard, you'll still do this because you'll save money.
Yeah.
You know, energy efficiency is just pointing out waste. Mm-hmm. And now renewable energy is actually bigger than fossil fuel energy in installing and in investment. It's kind of wild how fast that's happened since that 2010 to 2012 period when I was out talking about climate change specifically. I say specifically, we talked about all the solutions we could find for climate change. And so at that time, I was speaking with the companies about that, but then it pivoted. And I really got to thinking and learning about soil and how when we abuse our soils, we create more emissions of carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. And when we treat our soils really well, we draw down carbon dioxide and it becomes carbon in the soil. The O2 becomes oxygen. We breathe that. Mm-hmm. And so around 2012 was really where I started focusing on soils. And then I started focusing in on grazing because it looked like the biggest bang for the buck. Yeah. It looked like the fastest way to turn soils around. So, you know, started with this big, broad canvas of solutions to climate change. And then I thought, if I could only do one thing for the next decade, one thing, what's it going to be? And I focused on grazing. Hmm. And so that's when we made Soil Carbon Cowboys, the first film that became the sort of anchor for the series, Carbon Cowboys. It's now 10 films. And I kept looking for downsides to the way these folks were grazing their animals and the way they were treating their land and the way their lives were turning around. I still am looking for, like, okay, what's the drawback? And I just simply haven't found it. And yeah. So McDonald's, I started speaking with McDonald's in 2012 about this type of grazing. And we started speaking with Shell in 2013 about this type of grazing. And we can go into some stories there, but I just kept saying, hey, look, this is a potential solution. We need to do the research. So when you asked me the question about my CV, that's a new thing for me is I'm a wrangler of scientists. I'm now helping to lead a large research project to really understand adaptive regenerative grazing on one side of the fence, conventional grazing on the other. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? Is there a difference? There seems to be a difference, mm-hmm. but the science community doesn't take crazily enough. And I think this is something that should be adjusted. So they really don't take farmers' words to yeah. their success. They need to see data. It's mm-hmm. it's very interesting. And so I've met a bunch of scientists who also were excited by what they were seeing on these farms. And they had their specialty, bugs, birds, soil carbon, grazing. So we put together a team to look at the system, the natural system of science, the natural system of nature. And so that took about 4 years to put that team together, not to put the team together, but to design the project and then to get the money in hand.
Yeah.
So we've been out since 2018 researching that in the Southeast US. And what? McDonald's, from that 2012 conversation, came on board at the end of 2016 with the $4.5 million grant.
Wow.
And it's been amazing. I personally am aiming for big companies because I think we need them
yeah.
to move quickly.
Yeah. When you released the feature-length documentary Carbon Nation in 2010, a decade mm-hmm. ago now, which was about climate change solutions, what kind of a reaction did you get to that then? Because it feels like our understanding of climate change has come on in leaps and bounds over the last decade.
Yeah, I got a really good reception for that film.
Yeah.
Although it's kind of funny, the very first question at the world premiere in Washington, D.C., this guy accused me of being a propaganda guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I asked him what he meant by it, and he couldn't really back it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the very first question. And I said to him, I said, hey, listen, let's talk in the lobby afterwards. I really want to understand what you're saying. Because we made the film for people like my Uncle Phil, who didn't think climate change was happening.
Yeah.
And certainly didn't think humans were at the cause. And so, you know, in the movie, we have people who are doing amazing things with regenerative energy and renewable energy. And they don't even think climate change is caused by humans. Mm-hmm. So I really realized that the well of discourse had been poisoned, and it was pretty clearly poisoned by the fossil fuel industry. I think that's pretty clear. I've spoken to enough people in that industry who told me that themselves.
Yeah.
And so the reaction when we made the film was good, and London and Seattle were like two spots where I just traveled a lot. It was really well received. We had a lot of really cool screenings. I went to London 5 times in 2011. It was awesome. I love traveling over there.
Yeah.
I even know where my favorite bakery is, by the way.
Where's your favorite bakery?
It's in Shepherd's Bush. It's called Maison Suisse. It's Maison Suisse. French Moroccan bakery. It is so good.
I'll look it up next time.
Maybe. Yeah, please do. Please do. And so I got invited to all these places to speak. It changed my life. Mm. It was really because we were focused on solutions. The people who gave us money to make it, who donated it to our cause, said they were really interested because we weren't bitching and moaning.
Yeah.
And then we're showing the film, and it's 84 minutes long, and it's 80 minutes of solution with 4 1-minute problem islands. And we thought that that was a really good way to go. I don't need to be scared anymore. I don't do very well when I'm scared. I don't want to scare anyone. Mm-hmm. I want to inspire people.
Yeah.
And when we showed it to high school students, you know, they had never seen a climate film that made them feel empowered. You know, they saw careers. Mm-hmm. They gave it a standing ovation in Kentucky. You know, and I asked everyone in that audience, it was about 250 students. And I said, how many people here believe that climate change is real and human caused? Half the hands go up, half the hands stayed down.
Yeah.
And then I said, how many people here like clean air and clean water? All the hands go up. Mm-hmm. But that crowd that was 50-50 on climate change gave the film a standing ovation.
Yeah. Yeah, the world feels very polarized at the moment, and that illustrates it really well. And it feels like a lot of people do very quickly form an opinion. You know, a lot of people sort of blame that on social media and the way that we take in information now. And people won't even entertain the idea of listening to others. How do we get past this? How do we find the common ground so that we can move forward? Because as you've just said, we all want the same thing, don't we? We all want cleaner air and a better earth for our children. So how do we get there together?
I think the first thing is listening.
Yeah.
And the second thing is not calling the person an idiot before you meet them or before you start talking. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of people at our screenings for Carbon Nation. It was usually a niece dragged her uncle to the film.
Yeah.
And then during the Q&A, the uncle would ask me a question, and it sounded like my uncle. And I'm like, you and I are going to talk after the Q&A. It was kind of cool. It's like a pattern.
Yeah.
And so I would go up to this, usually a gentleman, and I would say, hey, good to meet you. For me, climate change is real. The science is strong, and the solutions are going to make this a better planet for everybody. What do you think? And it turns out that that's the first time that person had ever had someone like me say, what do you think?
Yeah.
And that was a magic moment. Hmm. And they said, thanks for asking. And then they would say, for me, climate change is a hoax. Al Gore is a fraud. And scientists are researching it because that's where all the grant money is. And they just want to get rich. Well, I wasn't in university before then, but I am at a university now, and I can tell you, scientists aren't getting rich from grant funding.
Yeah.
They get grant funding and they do the science. Mm-hmm. And I say, okay, so I'm not going to change your opinion about climate change, am I? And the guy says no. And then I say, and you're not going to change my opinion about climate change, am I? And he laughs. He says no. Now we're laughing. And I said, well, why don't we just table that?
Yeah.
And then I said, what do you think of solar power? And they love solar power. Everyone loves solar power, right?
Yeah.
It's like 90% of U.S. citizens want solar power. And these are old numbers. Mm-hmm. And then what do you think of wind? Wind is great. What do you think of energy efficiency? It's a no-brainer. You know, and all of a sudden, we're like talking about a very progressive energy policy. Mm-hmm. And do you like the government giving companies welfare? No. Well, did you know that worldwide, the fossil fuel industry is receiving $500 billion a year in subsidies and tax credits and all the stuff. I'm like, No, I did not know that. And that's such a hard number to get. Such a hard number. My researching buddy, Michael, he was digging for a long time. So those sorts of things, that just talking and listening, and then talking about solutions, and, you know, that gentleman wants a cold beer, but I bet you he doesn't want to give a kid asthma to make his beer cold. Mm-hmm. And here in Kentucky, I don't know the numbers now, but they've been recently, 93% of the electricity is from coal. Mm-hmm. And those coal plants give kids asthma. It's not a lefty thing. It's just science.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's ways to start talking about the heavier stuff, but you got to sort of establish a common ground. And now, Will, you're a farmer. I'm out here focused on soil for this many years. I've been looking for common ground, and it's the ground.
Yeah.
It's the soil.
Yeah.
And when we have farmers that are focused on soil health, I haven't met anyone who's against soil health.
No. Do you have any agricultural background at all?
None.
None at all?
None. I killed a cactus.
So when did you first get interested in soil health and carbon storage and regenerative
making carbonation, looking for solutions to climate change? That's what got me to the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
that's what got me to Madagascar and seeing deforestation with Conservation International helping me out. That's where I got up to the Marin Carbon Project in California back in 07 when we started. And down in South Africa, a guy named Peter Willis introduced me to some people and some ideas when we were making the film. And I had been on farm because here in Louisville, when I was a little kid, we lived out in the country. Our house was just sort of in the woods, but my buddy Stuart Brown's house, his family had a farm that he leased, and their dad leased it out to cattle. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to walk through a herd to get over to Stuart's house, which was unnerving.
Yeah.
But other than that, none.
Okay.
And so I came at this as an advocate for solutions to climate change, and I've quickly become an advocate for farmers. I love farmers. I love being on these farms. You know, with COVID, I'm supposed to be filming this summer, and I'm missing those farms. I am missing being on those farms. And I would love to have a farm that I could make a research farm for my university to teach people how to use regenerative practices. And so I have a dream about actually living on a farm now. And I don't know.
That's awesome. That's really cool.
That's my experience. What's your experience? You're a farmer. Have you been a farmer your whole life? Are you generations in?
Yeah, multi-generational, yeah. My family have farmed in this area for at least 10 generations. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was kind of born into it. So, I love it. And I think over here there's increasing focus on soil health as well. I mean, we've even got government ministers talking about it and talking about sort of financially rewarding farmers for improving the soil with a new UK ag policy, which is, you know, that's how much it's kind of in the headlines over here. So
that's good news. I'd love to learn more about that. We just had a bill introduced over here, two Republican, two Democrat senators, and it's called Growing Climate Solutions Act. And it's basically to get our Department of Agriculture, the USDA, to help farmers understand where they could get ecosystem services purchased from them, carbon and water credits and things like that, and get the USDA to start. It's a wild west right now to sort of get it all organized.
Yeah.
In our research, you know, when we talk to a lot of people, we've done a lot of socioeconomic research over the last 6, 7, 8 years. The top headline for us was that people trust nature. Mm-hmm. That was top. That this feels like a rural solution for an urban problem, climate change, water security, food security. And that this feels like a purple issue, purple in the United States, meaning it's, you know, the red Republicans and the blue Democrats, yeah. I don't know how the colors got chosen, could get behind that.
Mm. Do you think that So over here, there's certainly in the last few years, there's been a huge amount of interest in regenerative farming. It's kind of the buzz topic, really, in all the farming press and even in sort of mainstream press. Is that similar situation in the US, or is there quite a lot of skepticism about it? I mean, I look at the sort of the Midwest states, the I states, where there's kind of huge amounts of corn and soya grown, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Obviously for economic reasons, is there much sort of pushback from those farmers towards this, or are people getting increasingly interested in it?
Well, I'm focused on grazing, and you just brought in row crops, which are super important, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at I think it's the top four things we grow in row crop, I hope I get this right, wheat, corn, soy, and hay.
Yeah.
If you look at that and you put that on the left side of a scale, and then on the right side of the scale, you put all the soil we lose to erosion from plowing and not having cover crops and not doing no-till drilling for seeding. We lose more soil per pound than we produce food. Mm. That cannot go on.
That is a shocking statistic, isn't it?
For every pound of corn harvested, we lose 2 pounds of soil to erosion, either through wind or rain, because that soil is exposed.
Yeah.
And you know, with Carbon Cowboys, our short film series, you know, we made a film in Cornwall and Devon, and the River Tamer runs right between them. And I believe it's Plymouth Sound right at the bottom of that river.
Yep.
And they're dredging that frequently. And what are they dredging? They're dredging your beautiful golden English topsoil. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm seeing in just the last 6 months, and it was really building up like in February and March, was big multinational companies really understanding that their food security is at great risk. You know, that it was a UN, we can't find the attribution for what the UN used, but there was a UN spokesman in the last 10, 15 years who were saying, we've got about 60 years left in the UK of topsoil.
Yeah.
Business as usual.
Yeah. I mean, COVID has brought food security into sharp focus as well, hasn't it? I mean, it's literally on the front page of the newspapers. So, you know, if anything, that will focus government's minds more than ever, won't it, on this?
Well, it's really interesting how it ties in with all the renewable energy work that I used to be focused on. I still keep track of and still support. I just don't spend day to day on it. You know, the big discussion there was, let's not have these giant power plants that are, you know, a risk if there's ever terrorism, they're a risk if they ever stop working for a day or two, and let's get energy distributed. Let's have solar on everyone's roof, and let's have smaller power plants, and let's distribute this so that it's more resilient, right? And in the US, the meatpacking industry is so concentrated right now, where, you know, 80% or something, 85% of the meat that's, you know, sold in grocery stores is owned by four companies. And they have these giant meatpacking facilities where COVID was unchecked at first, and they had really, really bad outbreaks.
Yeah.
And they had to shut down. And so it's really slowed down that industry, and all the farmers who are selling their pigs and poultry and meat, beef into that industry, they're having to kill their animals and we're not eating them. It's devastating. It's a tragedy at the highest level. But the farmers in our films, they are seeing increased sales of 300 to 1200% because they're selling directly to their customers. More people want to buy from them because they're realizing, if I'm healthy, COVID won't be so damaging to me. I better eat healthy food. I know that farmer, or my friend knows that farmer. Let's buy from that person.
Yeah.
And so will that last? Will that continue? That's, I think, a very important question. What do you think?
It is. There's a lot of talk about that at the moment, whether people will go back to sort of their old habits. I mean, that's exactly the same here. All the farmers who are selling direct have seen unprecedented demand. And it's made a lot of people talk about it and how long and complicated our food chains are and how mm-hmm. we need to be shortening them again. And I think although, you know, people have busy lives, you know, they will, it's easier to go to the big supermarkets and buy everything in one place. I do hope it will make people think about things going forward, I think. And I hope it will.
But when I go to England and Europe, there's a much more of a tradition of buying food every few days as opposed to stocking up for a week or two like we do. Mm-hmm. And so I would think that model would fit itself better to keeping sort of this local food purchasing happening. Mm. And of course the consumer's in charge.
Yes.
And if the consumers say to Sainsbury's or you know, Woolies or, you know, over here Fry's or Kroger, I want local meat, right? That's what I want. Mm-hmm. And they actually stand behind it and buy it, then, you know, those distributors will respond.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. So Carbon Cowboys itself.
Yes.
Tell us how the project first began.
Well, it was like I said, when we were making Carbon Nation, we learned about soils, we learned about, you know, regenerative grazing.
Yep.
And then I pivoted and focused just on that because I was seeing how quickly people were rebuilding their soils and what looked to be like a very large carbon sink mm-hmm. in their soils. And so that's how it started that way. And it started, the first film was Soil Carbon Cowboys. So that's Alan Williams and Gabe Brown and Neil Dennis. And they're real pioneers in this type of grazing. Yeah. We call it adaptive multi-paddock grazing, AMP grazing for short. And so going to their operations and learning from them was a thrill. And then it was really hard to turn all their information into 12 minutes.
It was
really challenging. I remember when we were making that back in 2013, don't forget how hard this is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they introduced me to some people, a couple people called me out of the blue. Someone else says, hey, so-and-so, someone knew I was coming to the UK who I work with. And mm-hmm. she knew a guy at University of Exeter and he was doing his PhD work on regenerative farming in Cornwall and Devon. So that's how I met those two farmers.
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of word of mouth. And I think farmers have been on the defensive a lot of attacks.
Yeah.
And you know, there is industrial conventional farming that's doing huge damage. I just told you about the soil damage in the US and how much mm-hmm. soils we're losing. But farmers can also be the hero. And I wanted to celebrate the farmers who were, to me, doing amazing things with their land and then helping to solve big problems that aren't on their land.
Yeah.
And they weren't doing it to solve climate change necessarily. But I do think a lot of them now, even since when we filmed in 2014, 15, 16, I think a lot of those very conservative farmers that I filmed, I think they're really seeing, like you said earlier, that climate change is happening.
Yeah.
One of our farmers got hit by a hurricane that was so strong. And it was Hurricane Michael. And I watched the weather. That's like the only notification I have on my phone or iPad is from the weather service. No news headlines, none of that crap. And Hurricane Michael was just this tropical depression on the Yucatan. Mm-hmm. And within 24 hours or 36 hours, it moved north and it was a Hurricane 5 on the coast of Florida.
Yeah.
And you just don't see that. It wasn't predicted. Mm-hmm. And then it was still a Hurricane 3 when it hit White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia, our film 100,000 Beating Hearts. And they had massive damage from that storm. But I was the one telling Will, he's like, man, that was a big storm. I said, dude, that was the first band.
Yeah.
Because everything was out, but his cell phone was still receiving texts. And so I was like, batten down the hatches and get safe because it's coming now.
Yeah.
And so I think climate change is not a theory for a lot of people anymore.
No, I think it's something we're going to have to get used to, isn't it, over the coming years. I mean, we certainly, even though our farm, half the farm was underwater over winter, we had some of the worst floods we've had in a long, long time. And then this spring, we've had a 2-month drought. You know, it just seems to swing both ways. You know, it's quite worrying, I think.
Well, let me ask you, Will. What I've seen when folks are really focusing on soil health and they've changed their methods to a way that's letting nature sort of guide them, you know, basically not letting the soil be exposed is like rule number one.
Yep.
And then how biodiverse of a plant community can you put on your soil so you get that biodiversity of microbes and insects, right? And it's those folks who are the ones who have less flooding problems and less drought problems because their soils are either filtering the water in and it's going in and replenishing the groundwater system, or they're holding on to the moisture more during the drought. Are you seeing that on your farm?
Yeah, well, we sort of at the bottom of a river valley anyway, where we are. So we get an awful lot of water comes down from the mountains. So with the amount of rain that went on up there, it just sort of comes down in a big rush and ends up on our farm. But I spoke to someone for the podcast 6 or 7 weeks ago now, a guy called Adam Driver, who farms over in the east of England. And he does a lot of regenerative practice and he's big into it. And him and I were talking about it and he really made me think with some of the things he said on the podcast about how crazy it is that we've gone from farms that were underwater to very quickly later being dry as a desert. And that is crazy, really. And we should be able to keep that moisture in the soils. And it's hugely focused my mind. I mean, I've been answering questions. I've been a lot of webinars and reading a lot of books lately on regenerative farming. You mentioned Gabe Brown. I've read his book 3 times now and the audio book I've listened to as well. So
I'd like to listen to it. So let me ask you, you said a lot of water comes down to your farm. Yeah. Are there farms upstream?
Yes, there are. Yeah.
And so if those farms were practicing regenerative farming and had healthy, squishy soils, the impact on you would be lessened.
Yes. And that is something that's being talked about a lot here at the moment. Is certainly, I think, these extremes of weathers that we've mentioned have really, really focused people's minds on it. So
think about that. That's kind of where I like. So we're doing a big research project right now. We're comparing the adaptive grazing with the conventional grazing right across the fence with a whole lot of science teams. Measuring soil and greenhouse gas and all these different metrics, birds and bugs and biodiversity. But I'd love to see this where you get an entire watershed to change to regenerative practice.
Yep.
And so like here in Louisville, we've got this beautiful area of farming in Harrods Creek. It's a big creek. It's like a river in most of our country. Kentucky's got more flowing water than any other state, even though it's a small state. It's just got just a lot of moving water.
Wow.
And Harrods Creek feeds into the Ohio River right at Louisville's second water treatment plant. I think it's actually its biggest. And so there's got to be metrics of how much they have to clean it, you know, from all the nutrients in there, and how dirty is it during flood events and all these things. And my theory is that if we can get the farmers upstream in that watershed to be more regenerative, that the water that gets down to that water treatment facility is going to be cleaner on a day-to-day basis.
For sure.
Floods are going to be less powerful. And so that's what I want to do next. I want to see a watershed experiment. Maybe folks are doing it already and they'll hear this podcast and they'll direct me to their experiment.
Tell us what some of the individual farmers and ranchers involved in Carbon Cowboys. How did you first find them? I know you just said that some of them were sort of, you came across them through friends of friends and things like that, but were they keen to be involved? I would love to have some of their accents, by the way. Don't even get me started on the facial hair. Fantastic.
Oh yeah. Well, Neil Dennis wins facial hair competition.
Absolutely. He does. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, he's fantastic. And they all were keen, and certainly with Soil Carbon Cowboys, the first one, Alan Williams knew the fellow who narrated Carbon Nation. So he had a little bit of trust for me just because we had a colleague in common. Neil Dennis just said yes because Alan said, hey, I filmed with him. He didn't hurt me. Sounded like he was interested. And so what's great about Neil, you look at the footage. I mean, I got there and he just started talking. Yeah. And I was like, stop, hold. And I just got my camera together really quick, threw the mic on him. And like stuff that's in the first minute of the film is in the movie.
Wow.
He just was there for me and just wanted to tell his story because he had such an impactful story. And so I'm at his place for 2 or 3 days. And he passed away in 2018. And his son is now running his operation. And Neil was the sort of the front man for how many animals and how small a space for how short a time. Mm-hmm. You know, we call it adaptive multi-paddock grazing. It's like high stock, short, high density, short rotation, right? It's, and Neil, you'll see in the Soil Carbon Cowboys film, he's got 850 head on a half an acre.
Yeah.
And he moves them every 2 hours. And he leaves the last acreage open so they can get to the water trough. So they can always go back. So they get more and more space as the day goes on, but they don't want to. They pack in because they want the fresh food every 2 hours when the battery latch opens, mm-hmm. you know, automatically, and he's at home watching Oprah. And he was great. His wife, and you know, sometimes the farmer will ask you to stay at their farm because they live so far away from everything. So I stayed at Neil and Barbara's house. And Barbara was busy. She didn't really have much time. I wanted to interview her, but she didn't sound too interested, you know. And then, you know, we finished the film, and then it's seen in 150 countries and, you know, hundreds of thousands of eyeballs. And so she was like, if I had any idea of how many people were going to see this movie, I would have insisted that Neil not wear those Daisy Duke shorts. And yeah. He's wearing some shorts, man.
And, another one. And, you mean, yeah.
And so he was good. And then we get down to Gabe Brown, the third of the three.
Yeah.
And he was busy hosting a grass-fed exchange conference on his farm. It was like the hottest it had ever been in Bismarck, North Dakota. And he's got to cook, you know, 250 hamburgers or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't film when I got there. And I was really happy because I was really tired from filming Neil. And so we waited till after the conference, and then I filmed with him. And, you know, these folks, especially back then, not a lot of people knew about him.
Yeah.
Now Gabe Brown's, he's world famous and well-deservedly. And I think it's going to increase. I think he's going to be recognized. And I think Alan Williams is going to be recognized in a lot of ways.
Sure.
But when you do this kind of work and you get a chance to talk about it, it's exciting. Like when I make a movie, like with Carbonation, I was alone in an edit room for a year. And when I talked to my first journalist, he was like, you know, I'm sorry to bother you. And I'm like, I am so happy to be talking to somebody, you know, yeah. about this film. Yeah. So I think the farmers themselves, like Michael Thompson, the farmer in Kansas, he's in a film called During the Drought. He was studying Gabe Brown and he called me out of the blue. And I'm like, I think I need to come film you.
Yeah.
You know, and then I was going to be in Missouri and someone said, oh, you got to talk to Doug Peterson. He's in the short film, I Sell Water and Sunshine. Doug's amazing.
I like that one.
He's one of the few, he's in the USDA. He's one of those people that were trying to get people to focus on soil health much earlier than his colleagues, I would say. Mm-hmm. And he's stuck it out, man. And so it's growing within the government organizations. I think it's slower at the universities, but even the universities are starting to change now.
Yeah.
So we have seen a lot of pushback to these ideas. I got to say, we're still seeing pushback. The World Resources Institute just put out a paper a couple of weeks ago, a white paper. And it really felt like there's serious pushback to the climate potential of regenerative agriculture. Mm-hmm. And friends of ours and people on our team, actually, our science team, actually wrote a rebuttal that I thought was really cogent and didn't even include all the best papers they could have included in that. And so there still is inertia, I think.
Yeah.
The research we're doing right now, the first peer-reviewed papers are being written right now, and we're hoping over this year we'll start seeing them get published. The documentary I'm making about the research, we're editing that now. and it's just as hard as the first one. And it's actually a lot harder. And we hope to have that, you know, finished by the beginning of 2021. And then how do we get into film festivals? How do we distribute it? You know, all those things will be decided.
Sure.
So we hope that our work that's absolutely finding amazing successes with regenerative grazing, we hope our work gets through peer review, and then we can get loud.
Yeah, sure. Now, on all the films, every single one of the farmers and ranchers on there communicate extremely articulately what they're doing, as well as being hugely passionate about it, obviously. And so it's really entertaining watch, so that's one of the things that I most enjoyed about it, really, and why I think I engage with it so much. Is that something you were aiming for, or did it just happen naturally with them being so enthusiastic about what they do?
Well, they are naturally enthusiastic about what they do, but mm-hmm. having someone who's a good farmer doesn't mean they're going to be good on camera.
No.
Right? You know, with anything, like when we were making carbonation, we had great people in front of the camera and we had a lot of duds that didn't make it into the film, but we spent a lot of time filming them.
Yeah.
And so what I've learned is a quick phone call will tell you, is this a person to film or not?
Sure. Okay.
But that said, you know, I just trusted people. Like, you know, Alan Williams, I called him and I said, hey man, we're working so hard getting this research going. I need to film some more. And he goes, okay, I'm going to be in Georgia and South Carolina. I said, just hook me up and I'll follow your lead. And three of those four farms ended up being three of our films. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know Murray Provine, who's in This Farm is Medicine, before I met him. I didn't know Don Jackson before I met him. And I had just met Will Harris briefly at a grass-fed exchange conference. And Will and I spent 3 days together. Mm-hmm. And so I did just get lucky. Sure. And trust some of the folks who were saying, hey, you should go film these folks and stuff like that. But, you know, a lot of the filming, everything but the last one, the Texas film was the 10th one in the series that we filmed. The other nine, it's just me and a camera and a microphone. So I can, that's just a conversation like you and I are having right now. You can get people to understand that A, I'm there to celebrate them. B, I kind of get it. So I can ask them questions that they know means I kind of get it. Mm-hmm. And C, you know, I'm working hard, you know, I'm lugging my equipment around and farmers like seeing someone who's working hard.
They do. I really like the soundtrack and the snippets of music in the background too, by the way. I really liked it. I thought it was great.
Thanks. There's a lot of different composers there. Ben Soleil he's out of Lexington, Kentucky. He's a cellist. Okay. And he, through his record company, Sonoblast, they gave us music.
Cool.
And so on about four of our short films, it's Ben Soleil's music. And then I've got a buddy named Rob Hawes, and we use some of his music on the film up in Canada, The Luckiest Places on Earth. And then we find some music online sometimes. And then I love music. Mm-hmm. And so the 100,000 Beating Hearts film, that music, which we used again, and I think we used it again in the Don Jackson film, Givers and Takers, that was stuff that I worked on for about a year. I would just noodle on the guitar while my boys were small and in the bathtub, you know, every night. Okay. And then I gave all these noodlings to my buddy Todd Johnson, who's here in Louisville, who's just a phenomenal musician, phenomenal songwriter, just a super cool guy. And then he turned him into what you hear. Cool. And God, it was so good to work with him. And he's an interesting story. So Todd is vegan.
Okay.
And so when I wrote him or called him, I said, hey, I'd love to collaborate with you. But it's about meat production. I know you're vegan. Your wife's mm-hmm. vegan. He's raising three really talented, cool kids who are vegan. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, show me the footage. And I showed him a rough cut. He goes, God, those animals are really treated well. I said, yeah, they're treated really well. They're allowed to be themselves.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, that's why I'm vegan. You know, part of the reason was animal treatment. A big part of his reason of going vegan was mistreatment of animals.
Yeah.
And so that was in 2015 and 16 when we were collaborating on that. And I was sitting on my porch with him in March of this year, and he just sort of dropped that he bought meat recently from a farmer he knew. And Wow. He knew how the food was being produced, how the animals were being raised. And I sort of snapped both ears. I'm like, I'm sorry, Todd. I thought you just said you bought meat. And he did. And so I don't think he's like eating meat a lot or all the time. Mm-hmm. But boy, that's right. It's a big treatment of animals is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I read just this morning that the fashion company Timberland are going to start sourcing their leather from regenerative farming systems.
Yeah.
Do you foresee that other companies will follow suit with this? And if so, surely that opens up a big potential revenue stream for this type of agriculture.
Absolutely. And I don't know all the decision makers at Timberland, but I can say that Timberland is a supporter and a funder of our research. They funded our social science research.
Okay.
Sure. And along with Wrangler and the company called VF Corporation, which maybe used to stand for Vanity Fair, that owns Timberland and Wrangler. So they've supported us. There was a phone call with Timberland in about 2015 or 16 when we were, you know, having that discussion of would you guys like to fund us? And they said on the call that they just can't get the carbon footprint down at leather.
Yeah.
Leather was where it was so high. And I said, well, what if you got leather that actually made the earth better? Mm-hmm. And the woman I was speaking with said, say that again. And I said, what if you got leather that made the world better, that actually drew down more carbon than it was emitted in the making, in the growing of that animal's life? And she said, that's doable. I said, well, that's our research. That's what we're working on, to see if grazing can be a climate change sink all the way around, methane, nitrous oxide, and CO2. Mm-hmm. So I know that our work was at least a factor in there somewhere. And I love that they're doing that.
I'm so glad you asked that question there. That's really cool, because I didn't realize that at all. So.
But imagine that, right? Imagine folks who want, then you start really influencing the producers, but we have to figure out a way to influence the producers where it's not making them do something.
Yeah.
It's incentivizing, presenting the options, showing the benefits, letting them make the decision, but really giving them all the facts. Yeah. And that's what I'm hoping the research we're doing right now we designed it. We hoped it would show that adaptive grazing is a climate sink. And, you know, we're still getting the data in on that, because we want farmers to be as profitable, and we want their land to be as regenerated, and we want the water cycles to be as vibrant and robust as possible.
Yeah.
Right? I want you to have the most amazing land that is so much more regenerated than it was, you know, in generations past, your dad and your grandfather, your grandmother, your mom, you know, and there's ways to do it.
Yeah.
And so why should we keep that a secret?
What do you think some of the barriers are for farmers who are running their farms conventionally and getting into more regenerative systems? I mean, I read about the yeah, but syndrome on your website. So yeah, but that won't work on my farm. And Gabe Brown speaks a lot about that in his book, Dirt to Soil. How do we get past that with farmers? Is it just time? Is it just a new generation of farmers coming through, do you think?
I was talking to a journalist who wrote a very kind of conservative, sounded like didn't think regenerative agriculture was worth the trouble kind of article, but there was one line in it I like reaching those people, right? I want to talk to him. So I reached out to him and he called back and we had a lot more common ground than we both would have guessed by his tone of his article. So that's what I'm talking about. If you just talk to people one-on-one, you find common ground. So that's not quite your question, but your question about yeah, but. So Michael Thompson, the film During the Drought, we see a scene where he's planted corn and his neighbors planted corn on the same day, same corn, mm-hmm. same hill. There's not even a fence. And Michael's corn is deeper, greener, taller, healthier.
Yeah.
Because he's been doing no-till and he's been grazing on that land and his neighbor has not. Mm-hmm. And his neighbor said, yeah, but you got more rain than I did.
Yeah.
Right? That was really the beginning of my yeah, but. And I'm like, yeah, but. And in a way, maybe he did. Because the effective rainfall, he would have absorbed more rain than his neighbor. Mm-hmm. He would have gotten more rain, effective rainfall, than his neighbor. So his neighbor's right.
Yeah.
But that being said, Alan Williams and Gabe Brown and this guy Ray Archuleta, they've started a company called Understanding Ag, and they have a not-for-profit division called the Soil Health Academy. And General Mills is supporting them. I think $1.6 million they've given to them so that farmers can have a subsidy to come and not have to spend all the money for their workshops and their training, but still have skin in the game. But, you know, it's being subsidized by General Mills because General Mills wants to change the way Americans farm. And it's real. Yeah. It's amazing. And so what Alan says, because that's a question that comes up in every one of their workshops, every one of their on-farm workshops, Alan says, I've got one rule. You cannot say, this will not work on my farm.
Yeah.
But what you can say is, how can I get this to work on my farm? And he says that that little switch changes the whole conversation for the whole workshop. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the game, right? Farmers have to see it, right? Of course they do, right? So we got to have enough places for farmers to go. We have to have enough demonstration farms in varying ecosystems so the farmer can see it's a similar place to mine, but it's not my neighbor's.
Yeah.
And we see a lot of times folks don't listen to their neighbors, but they'll listen to someone from another state. And I asked a farmer about that, and their theory was no one wants to listen to someone they went to high school with.
Yeah, farmers are the same all over the world.
And so, but there's got to be a time when, you know what, maybe your neighbor is doing something pretty cool.
Yeah.
And your neighbor would probably like to tell you about it, but your neighbor's too polite to tell you about it.
Yeah.
And if you're too polite to ask, then that neighbor conversation, and I'm seeing that very scenario, mm-hmm. you know, and it's happened on our research, you know, too polite.
Increasingly in the UK, there are events around regenerative farming. There's a fantastic one called Groundswell in the southeast of England, which I attended last year, the whole event around regenerative farming. And there's been a real buzz about that over the last few years. It's really grown. I went for the first time and I came away from it feeling really positive and re-energized, which I haven't done with any of the other sort of ag shows around. Are there any events like that in the US where people can go to see it in action?
I just want to ask you a question. Why were you charged up? Like, what about it? I'm going to guess. Let me guess. Because you had your feet on the ground on successful farms.
Yes. And it was, I think over the last few years, like a lot of farms, as our input costs have gone up, so the cost of sprays and fertilizers and machinery, like, you know, you now you go to buy a combine or a tractor, it's like the price of a house, you know.
Yep.
It's become to really kind of turn me off. And I look at all the sprays we have delivered and I think this isn't right. You know, we're not doing this right. And going there was like a real light switch moment for me, really. I spoke to such a lot of people there. Alan Savory was talking and they had a lot mm-hmm. of high profile people from all around the world. And it just all seemed to make sense to me. A little switch went in my head and I thought I need to be doing this at home. And I came away buzzing, really, just massively re-enthused for farming and everything that I do. And ever since then, I've been looking more and more into it and starting to make small changes on the farm. So
what we found in the States is after a farmer's been charged by a great event, like the Grass-Fed Exchange does a really good event like that, where you, there's farm tours that are much more important than the conference talking. And you need to make sure when the farmers get home that they have a place to go to immediately.
Yeah.
And that's what General Mills is doing with the Soil Health Academy, is they're making sure there's a phone call waiting for them when they get back from the week-long workshop. And now in a visit, it's like, okay, now you're home.
Yeah.
Let's walk through your operation and let's really walk through all the opportunities. And because that's a sort of a gulf of inspiration at the event, go home. How do I do it here?
How do you
What's the first step?
Practice? Yeah, that's it, isn't it? The first step is often the most difficult one, I think, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. So I've got to ask you, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to, of all the short films, which is your favorite? Is this like asking you which is your favorite child? I guess it is.
No. I won't just give you one. I'll just tell you why certain ones are. Soil Carbon Cowboys was the first one, and it was much more viewed than I ever thought possible for a film that we didn't even promote. You know, that we didn't promote these films while we made them. We just did the promotion just recently, which is how you heard about us.
So
that one's the starter, and I learned so much, and the guys I got to film were so cool.
Yeah.
But each film has a special spot. It really does. You know, spending all that time with Will Harris, and that film did the best in the film festival circuit, right?
Did it. Okay.
It really kicked butt that way.
Yeah.
So those two are paramount. And then the third one, the last one that we filmed, Herd Impact, it was so great to have a woman as the central character. And she and her husband have such a temper, at times fiery relationship. So having that and seeing that, and then she would say to me, she's like, she was really worried that her husband Emery wouldn't really respond to the filming. Like he's a quiet man. And after our day of filming, she said, "Emery spoke more to you today than he's spoken in a year."
That was funny.
Right? And so that's a really cool thing. And then, the film we made in New Mexico, the owner's a woman with her brothers who weren't in the film. And then the manager, that manager guy, Melvin Johnson, he's just such a, I don't know if you've seen that film yet. It's in New Mexico. And he was so reticent to change because he had seen where people had failed trying to do these methods. He knew it wouldn't work. But the owner, the dad died. The children wanted to go towards regenerative grazing. And they said, "We want you to stay, but you got to do this." And just seeing how his response to not wanting to do it and seeing during a 15-year drought how things changed so quickly. And from his perspective, like that was great. That was really showing me that this type of grazing can work in so many different locations. Like, I don't know. I'm not a farmer. I'm a fan of farmers, right? I don't know. If you threw me down on a farm and gave me cattle and said, "Go," I'm sure I would make every mistake in the book. And then I could write a comedy show, and then I could go on tour amongst farmers, and everyone would laugh. But I trust the people I'm talking to because they're on the land they're talking about. And you can feel it. You can smell it. And you can hear it. You hear the bugs. You feel the squishiness of the soil and that thatch covering the soil. You can feel it. So
where can people go to find the films?
CarbonCowboys.org.
And I would urge anyone listening to do check them out, because I watched them. I actually watched them with my 9-year-old daughter, by the way, and she really enjoyed them too. So that's interesting, I think.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was really good. Really enjoyed them. And as I say, I would urge anyone listening to check them out. So let's wrap this up, because I know I'm very conscious of time. We'll wrap it up with the five quick questions to end the traditional hard-hitting questions. Peter, what is your all-time favorite song?
Oh, you know, Stevie Wonder is way up there. Beatles are way up there. But Stevie's got this song called As.
Yeah.
From Songs in the Key of Life.
I know it, yeah.
I'm going to go with Stevie's As. He just turned 70 in May.
That's going with Stevie. Brilliant choice. Okay, you've traveled all around the world with your work. Where's the best place you've been?
The prettiest place that had the most impact on my life, because my wife and I decided to be really kind of decide to give this relationship a shot, was in Wales.
Yes. That's where I live.
So I'm calling it Wales.
That is the correct answer. You can come back on the podcast, Peter.
But I can say that Wales is the Kentucky of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I can see that, actually. I can see that from obviously with the heritage, with the coal and the sort of landscape as well.
Well, I wasn't talking about the coal heritage, yeah, but that's a whole can of worms there. But I mean the beauty.
Yeah, the beauty. So, yeah. You are a filmmaker, so I have to ask you, what is your favorite film?
You know, you can kind of break it down into serious films, comedy films, but I love like silly comedy films like Tropic Thunder. I can't turn off. If it's on, I will then be up the rest of the night watching it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think the Coen brothers really are phenomenal. I'm going to go with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh Brother, it's such a good film. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Talk about soundtrack.
Yeah, definitely. I've got the soundtrack album. That's brilliant.
I saw them do the soundtrack live at Carnegie Hall.
Did you? Wow.
Yeah.
I'm super jealous.
It was sold out. I showed up on the day, because this is a trick. If you show up on the day of a sold out event, sometimes tickets are released that they thought they had given to people. And I got a beautiful seat.
Amazing.
Yep.
Cool. What is the best part of your job? I think I can guess, but what is it?
Meeting people.
Yeah, I was right.
Learning from them, talking to them.
Yeah.
Being wherever they're at. Mm-hmm. And I'm a insanely curious person. Mm-hmm. And so just having the license to ask any question I can think of.
Yeah.
It's a thrill.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And lastly, then, I don't know how active on social media you are, but there's a lot of very good communication work being done by farmers on there across all the social media platforms. Have you got a favorite agricultural related social media account to follow?
Ooh. I just really started focusing on being active in social media with this Carbon Cowboys release. Mm-hmm. We had a really cool PR firm in London called Browning PR. And I learned a lot. And my wife, Krishna, who produces all the films and runs our not-for-profit, all the business side, she's doing an awful lot. I just don't know yet. I would say to you, Will, with that question, you need to send me a list of your favorites.
I was just going to say, I can recommend.
And I'll do I'll look into it, because that's a world I'm just learning.
Sure. Well, I can certainly recommend you plenty of people who are doing really good work with regenerative farming over here. So I'll do that for sure.
Please do.
Peter, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and learn more about what you do. Congratulations again on Carbon Cowboys. It really is superb. It's given me a lot to think about, and I'm sure it will other farmers too. So keep up the great work. And once again, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, Will. It's been a pleasure, a real pleasure.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.